help my family with some aspects of my parents' transition and their living situation. And as it turned out, I was the only one from my family here that could make that trip. And so I had this rather substantial prairie drive to do all by myself. I don't mind that. I grew up in northern Saskatchewan. I went to school in southern Saskatchewan. I live 45 minutes outside of the city. Like, long drives are, you know, familiar. I don't mind them. But usually those drives, because the last 25 years or so of our lives as a family have involved kids, still do. So because of that family aspect, that extended family aspect, it's a little unusual for me to go for a drive this long by myself. And so I figured that what I would do with this luxury of Winnipeg to Saskatoon is I would catch up on a backlog of my music listening. And I figured since I was by myself, I could play whatever I wanted without any negotiating, and I could play it as loud and as long as I wanted, and I could sing along, I could whistle, I could hum tunelessly if I chose. By the way, that's basically a list of all the things I sometimes do anyway that seem to annoy the heck out of, you know, family members who shall remain nameless because they're not here to defend themselves. And so that's what I did. And the artist that I chose, was Bruce Hornsby. Now, I'm not going to nerd out on this too much, but most people remember Hornsby for a couple of hits in the mid to late 80s, a skeptical but very powerful race song called That's Just the Way It Is, a subsequent sort of almost maudlin love song called Mandolin Rain. The fact is that this guy is not primarily a pop artist. He's not primarily a pop songwriter, despite the airplay those some of those songs still get. He is actually a virtuosic musician who has a commanding grasp of more styles than I can name, and the ability to meld those styles in real time that is quite remarkable. And he's also got pretty mad improvisational skills. He loves to just like totally bust out live. I love him best live. And his band, okay, maybe I'm going to get just a little bit fanboy. His band isn't even given a set list before his live shows. They are expected to be able to follow him wherever he goes, and he goes to crazy places. And his stage signals are pretty subtle, like it's this little hand thing or this little eyebrow thing. Like, it's not a big production watching him with his band, and they are good enough to do that. So that's a pretty remarkable thing. So I was just going to have myself a Bruce Hornsby Fest, and I knew it was going to be a good drive when I found myself, like, bursting into tears about myself driving down the number one, going, oh, wow, about this interaction that was happening between him and his band live. It was just like this magic. And anyway, I that's also something I'm less likely to do with the car full of people, by the way, especially if I'm at the wheel. Most of you know that I find a pretty significant link between the ideas running in the background of musical improvisation and in the background of healthy spirituality. And so maybe that's what was going on. Maybe I was just, you know, overcome by the volume of the music or the width of the prairie sky or the reason for my trip or all of the above. I don't know, but I was having a moment. In any case, on that same album that moved me to tears, Hornsby has a song called This Too Shall Pass. And this is the lyric of the opening stanza of that song. Gotta get something done today, give accomplishment a shot. Might not have a full palette to use, but I'm going to paint with the colors I've got. And I haven't been able to get that lyric out of my head for the last couple of weeks. I might not have a full palette to use, but I'm going to paint with the colors I've got. And it's got me thinking about lots of different things, but one of them is the balance of things that we explore together here. The idea of working with what you've got rather than sitting and being stalled because we don't have single-minded clarity about our beliefs feels like an important spiritual truth to me. And for me, this is also connected to another part of my Saskatoon trip. One of the reasons that my parents have this sort of abrupt housing transition happening in their lives is because, as many of you know, my mom had a stroke on the September long weekend. And as these things go, it was a small one, and her recovery is going very well, and I'm deeply grateful for all of your support. Like, thank you more than I can or will take the time to try to express. It means a great deal. One of the primary symptoms of that stroke for my mom was the loss of stereo vision. In the words of her attending ophthalmologist, her eyes got a divorce. they were not talking to one another, and they went their own ways. And when you lose stereo vision, all kinds of things go sideways, sometimes literally. You lose your depth perception. Your balance gets wonky. You start to see multiples of things. Not a happy experience for the visioner. And the same thing, intriguingly, in the physical realm is true for stereo hearing. The fact that we hear with two ears helps us hear where a sound is coming from, which helps us locate it, which makes us able to move more safely through the physical world.
Can I just say that I don't have stereo hearing?
And you're not the only person in the community who doesn't, either. Like, so there are people here in this community who experience the challenge of this. Yeah. So if you want to sneak up on Sarah, which side should we use? I'm never mind.
Well, I completely get what
you're— I wasn't actually asking you to tell
it.
Okay.
The worst is being called in a crowded place because I don't know where the sound is coming from. I'll just do circles until I see someone way back.
So now we can be more sensitive to what Sarah going in circles means. It means, where the heck are you, right? Stereo hearing. Yeah, it's huge. Yeah. So that characteristic, thank you. I couldn't have illustrated it better, I'm sure. The characteristics of multiples being helpful spills over into the rest of our lived experience, right? So this is where we get an idiom like two heads are better than one. It's important that that's an idiom. But anyway, two heads are better than one. Why we would have ancient wisdom, like the biblical book of Proverbs, saying to us that there is wisdom to be found in the counsel of many. These ideas are interrelated. And the Bible, as a collection of stories, behaves this way as well. That's a pretty crazy collection, the Bible. Like, as a library, it's a little wild. You gotta say, it's got some range. One of the huge pluses of the craziness of the collection that we call the Bible is that it offers a lot of different perspectives, different vantage points on any number of significant things. That's one of the characteristics of that sacred text. Sometimes in that text, Book of Proverbs comes most readily to mind, we get these different vantage points almost side by side. In fact, in Proverbs, there's a couple of instances where we do get them side by side, actually, like verse after verse. So let me give you a classic example here. Proverbs 26, verse 4 says, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. So that's 26, verse 4. Good advice. Proverbs 26, verse 5 says, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. We could just talk about that, but we're not going to. I love that in Proverbs, all the fools are men and all the wisdom figures are women. It's true in Proverbs. In a binary, like in a two-gendered world, that's funny. Okay? I just think there's something deeply amusing to me as a male about that. In a non-binary gendered world, it's still funny. It's just more complex. And that complexity, I think, is actually a window into the way Proverbs behaves. Again, for another day. That's just an illustration of the way that our sacred text, if we are referencing the Bible as our sacred text, offers these multiple vantage points, sometimes just that tight together. And of course, if we kept going with that examination, we have four quite different stories about the life and times of Jesus in the Gospels. And the writers of the Gospels, intriguingly, aren't all that concerned about details. There's a number of instances, for example, where they don't seem to know which side of the lake something important happened on. Like, it's just not important to them. What they were committed to was getting people inside the story in transformative ways, and they were completely fine with telling the story in the way that they thought would make the best connection for their audience. And we haven't even talked yet about the multifaceted nature of the parables. So, this is characteristic of this sacred text of Christendom, that it offers these different points of view on most of the significant themes or events that form the basis for that religion. And those perspectives aren't all what we would call Christian. So this is intriguing as well. Christianity, in terms of its history, follows on the Jewish tradition, on Judaism. And if we're interested in understanding Christian spirituality better or engaging it more thoughtfully or deeply or critically, that's not a small matter. The person that gave Christianity its name, Jesus Christ, was a Jew. was a first century Jew and had a first century Jew's perspective on things. And that's not insignificant when we come to the text. So we just need to be, we're going to be wise about our spiritual explorations, and we are doing that exploration in the context of Christianity. We just need to keep that in mind. Last week, we were poking around in Genesis. Genesis is, of course, an ancient Hebrew text. And it is written in stereo, right from the beginning. Two different stories, like right from the start. And just to keep it interesting in terms of the text and our experience of it, the second story is chronologically older than the first. So if we were going to come to the text, for example, hoping for the tidy frame of a chronological linear unfolding of the human evolution and understanding of God, we're going to be in trouble before we get to chapter 2 of the text, because the older story is second. It's interesting. Anyway, but if we look at them in the order that we have them in our present day collection, they offer two different points of view on this idea of beginnings. So in the first story in Genesis, we touched on this last week, we find out that we have our basic stuff, whether we think of that as dust, as the story tells it, or stardust, as astronomers of today like to talk about it. We have our basic stuff in common with all of the rest of the world around us. In terms of who we are, what it means to be human, that means, among other things, that we are related to all other living things. And we share the breath of life. We participate in the same basics of birth and death and reproduction and recycling and renewal. If we want to use that tree image from Genesis again, we're a branch. We're a branch of the tree of life. And there are many different branches in that image. I read someone last week who suggested that this is a pretty good partial definition of God. That God is the one through whom we're related to and connected to everything. God is the one through whom we are related to and connected to everything. Eastern Orthodox spirituality would use a phrase like, the one from whom all things come and to whom all things shall return. Same idea. Different image. An image of source, of sending and retrieving, of source and return to source. The first story in Genesis tells us that as humans, we are good. All of us. It tells us that this goodness is rooted in our bearing the image of the divine. And it's an intriguing story for many reasons, but one of them is that it doesn't make any distinctions about who is in on this goodness. And that is a rather remarkable thing, given that it's a story that comes from a particular people, a particular tribe, in this case, the Hebrews, the Israelites. And it comes from that tribe at a point in that tribe's history when they were having an identity crisis and they needed some shoring up. But even under those circumstances, the story doesn't make such a distinction. Good. All good. All good. It's also written at a time when powerful, wealthy people, that point of the pyramid that we talked about a few weeks ago, that Egyptian image of power, that the people at the tiny point of the pyramid who held most of the wealth and sometimes all of the power, it seems, that those people were close to the divine. But the rest of the people had to have their experience of the divine mediated by those at the tiny top. So this story comes from that period of history, but it's a story that's written about ordinary folks. It's not written about power brokers. It's written about a hunter-gatherer couple living in a garden with absolutely nothing to their name. They don't even have, in the story, clothing. They have nothing. But they're in. That's fascinating. So there's this story right at the beginning of the text that says that irrespective of things like nationality or gender or age or socioeconomic status or power or religion, we all bear God's image, no exceptions. And then we come to the second story, and this is where the stereo part kicks in. In story one, we've got this potential telling of all good. And in story two, we encounter the possibility of not good. One garden, two trees. One is the tree of life. And when you think about the tree of life in terms of an image, I find it helpful to think about all the things that I think about when I'm musing about what does it mean to be really alive. I think about health and strength and thriving and fruitfulness and growth and vitality, all those kinds of images. But what about the second tree? What might that signify? Well, we had a good shot at this, I think, a few weeks ago when we talked about the evolving human moral brain and the idea of original grace. But here's another perspective. We could think of that second tree as our human inclination to play God. And in particular, to do that by judging parts of creation, which the first story names as all good, as not good. Don't answer this, but how far do you trust your judgment? I mean, I can't even consistently measure the distance from my car tire to the curb, you know, like never mind, infallibly judge good and evil. When we humans start making ultimate judgments about good and evil, how long do you think it might take before we just categorically say that person is good and deserves to live and that person is bad and deserves to die? How long do you think it'll take us before we do that with a species? Oh, wait, how often are we doing that with species? What about a river? What about an entire ecosystem? What about an entire culture? So this pair of stories can be read as presenting us with a critical human choice. Do we press into seeing the goodness of the world around us with all of the complexity and the ambiguity that that can bring with it, that I would even say that that does bring with it, or do we lean toward the territory of either or judgment, which carries with it the potential for misjudging and mistreating both the people and the world around us? Now, there's a lot in an idea set like that that is not crystal clear. If I was going to put what I just said into the image from the Hornsby song, we don't have a full palette here. We don't have a full palette to use. But we have more than one color. We have more than black and white. We can choose to paint with the colors we've got instead of stalling out trying to get things into either or, into the framework of judging and dismissing. And I said in the blurb that it seemed that Jesus had an opinion about this, and this is the story I was thinking of when I wrote that. It's from the book of Mark, the Gospel of Mark. And it's a story, I choose to read it as a story about the complexity and beauty of this challenge of painting with the colors we've got. The setup for the story comes at the end of chapter 2 in Mark. I'm not going to read the whole story, but you can go read it for yourself. What's happening at the end of Mark chapter 2 is Jesus, who has never been all that great about keeping the rules, religious rules of the culture that he grew up in. It's not about dishonoring them, just there's something else going on. So the way the story goes at the end of chapter 2 in Mark is that Jesus and his disciples are walking through a field, and it's the Sabbath, and they're picking some heads of grain off the stalks of grain that are beside the trail, and they're eating them while they walk along. And the people who are the gatekeepers of the religious rule system, which rule system is very elaborate regarding what constitutes work on the Sabbath, which includes harvesting, you know, picking things and eating them. They see this happen, and they just get all over his case about it. He gets called on the carpet about it. How come you don't seem to care that your followers aren't keeping the Sabbath? And the way that Jesus answers the question is he says, the Sabbath was made for humans, not humans for the Sabbath. And the way that he illustrates his answer is by telling a story about King David, the king of Israel, who historically was the one that like nailed it. And I'm not saying he obviously wasn't perfect, we all know his story. But in Israel's zeitgeist, David was the instance where everything rocked for a while. The Israelites asked for a king. The prophet said, you don't really want a king. Look at your neighbors. It's like, we've been looking at our neighbors. They all have kings. We want a king. Okay, you can have a king. But sometimes it's going to be really hard because kings kind of power up sometimes. Okay, but we still want a king. So this is the backstory. They get this string. If you read the stories about the kings of the Israelites, oh my goodness. don't even do the math. There's only like two good ones. I mean, like it's just it's such a short list of good kings and such a huge list of shitty ones. It's just way out of whack, you know? David was one of the winners, okay? During the time when David was the king, the Israelites were crushing it, at least part of the time. When Jesus answers the story about the Sabbath, he picks on a David story. And he says to the people, he says, you remember when David was on the run from, so before David came to power, when David was on the run from the king before him, and he's got this band of hooligans at that point. It's like a Robin Hood story, basically, right? I mean, David is like this beleaguered underdog. He collects up all the other beleaguered stragglers, and they're on the run. So they're hiding and doing fugitive-y kind of things, and they're hungry. And what they do in their hunger is they break into a sacred space, and they take this bread that is just there for the priests. It's a super specific, potent religious symbol. And David, who could be justified for stretching the rules a little bit because he turned out good, doesn't just take some bread and have some for himself. He gives it to all the losers that are with him, too. So that's the story Jesus tells to defend this answer about not following the rules of the Sabbath. And by trying to make the point, no. The Sabbath is a thing we made to serve us, not the other way around. Fascinating. Okay, that's just the setup for what keeps... So the next story, beginning of Mark chapter 3, we could just mine that other story all day, man. There's so much going on in there. The next story, though, is... Oh, I wanted to say one other thing about Sabbath. Good thing I have some notes. Because it could sound like Jesus is beating up Sabbath as an idea in that story, and he's actually not. It's not hard to tell that Sabbath is a good idea. All you got to do is go into the bookstore and find a book on digital detox, find a book on... I saw one last week about reclaiming the weekend as a way of fighting back against the cult of work. Isn't that fascinating? That was like just your standard bookstore fare. Sabbath basically means stop. Like the word just means stop. Sabbath is a great idea. Jesus wasn't saying Sabbath was a bad idea. Jesus was saying Sabbath isn't a black and white idea. It's made to serve us, not the other way around. That's what he said. Anyway, just want to say something good about Sabbath, because otherwise there'd be nobody here next week. No. So then the story goes on, and I do want to read you this bit from the beginning of Mark chapter 3. Another time, just so you know the stories are related, Mark's making sure we know. Another time, Jesus went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. So they watched him closely to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath, which would be work, right? You can't, you know, take some effort, this healing stuff. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, stand up in front of everyone. And then Jesus asked them, so the crowd in the synagogue, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save a life or to kill? But they remained silent. He looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts, said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees, the religious gatekeepers, went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. That's a very compressed story. Because what happens in between the last two sentences of the story is like all hell breaks loose in the synagogue. Like get there for a second, right? If you think about this as an actual lived experience in a community of faith, can you imagine the 2 minutes after the guy, whatever happens, he's healed? Kale, my son, Kale, would say about that, like the head's exploded. What was that? It's a great story. There are things in this story that make me really twitchy, of course. Like the idea of using a differently abled person as an object lesson. Okay? You know. Anyway, different culture, different time. That holds some of the freight, but just I'm still twitchy when I read that part. But all that acknowledged, any story can usually run in several directions at once. I'm going to take this one in a particular direction for a couple minutes. I think at the heart of this story, there's a collision between the folks that are approaching their spirituality with only black and white in their palette and Jesus, who seems to have more colors to work with. And it's complicated, of course, and Jesus illustrates that complexity with his rhetorical questions about what's right to do on the Sabbath. Jesus asked, as Mark tells us the story, Jesus sets this up. This is, was at a house concert with my friend Steve Bell last night. And he said at one point in that concert, he said, if Jesus wasn't anything else, he was a pretty good performance artist. Like, he kept doing things that made you go, huh? Right? Like in public, never mind at the synagogue. There's a little bit of performance art going on here. And Jesus sets the crowd up with a set of either-or questions, right? What's lawful on the Sabbath? Is it lawful to do good or evil? Black or white. Is it lawful to heal or to do harm? Black or white. It's a setup. It's totally a setup. Because Jesus is about to do something that is so ambiguous in terms of black and white law that there's no way it fits into that grid. And part of what makes me twitchy about the story actually illustrates that. Is this all good? Like, would any of us actually affirm dragging another human being out to make an object lesson? Even if it has a happy ending? Like, categorically? If we were kind of being either or about it, would we say that's a good idea? Probably not. So there you go. It's complex.
Did the man ask to be healed earlier?
There's lots missing from the story.
Did Jesus say, hey, wait a minute, are you okay with being in public?
Who can
say?
Yeah. So who can say, right? Yeah. Right? So there's all these complexities. There's all these layers to the story. But Jesus sets it up as either or. And then does something that just drags all of that complexity into it. Rather than parking the possibility for good, because to move forward on that possibility engages complexity, engages a whole bunch of colors or a whole bunch of shades of things, there's movement toward good. When Jesus asks the either-or questions of the crowd that's gatekeeping black and white spirituality, black and white religion, their response is very important. Their response is that they are silent. They say nothing. They do nothing. Why? Because they are waiting for their version of clarity to be either answered to or not answered to, so they will know where they stand. Jesus' unique ire in this story is reserved for that silence. Mark uses the word angry. Fascinating in and of itself. Jesus, he says, was angry. And it was with that attitude. It was with the choice to not act because they did not have legal clarity about what was right and what was wrong. Because they wanted to paint with black and white. And until they knew if Jesus was going to be black or white, they were not going to move. It's as if Jesus is saying, You can wait for that kind of clarity before you act. But in the meantime, you're not painting with the colors you've got. You're not doing what you could. The way that love of any kind behaves, never mind divine love, is that we can't know it without doing it. Like, the object and the journey are the same thing. To know love, we have to love. Others reveal themselves to us when we love them. We can learn about something, but we don't know it until we love it. That's painting with the colors we've got. Anyone who has ever loved another person knows the complexity of this idea. Because sometimes the colors we discover are not the colors we were hoping for or we thought we were going to get or blah, 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 right? Like, this is not an uncomplicated idea. Love is not an uncomplicated idea. Painting with the colors we've got is not an uncomplicated idea. Which is why I appreciate that Jesus doesn't try to make, and Mark doesn't try to tell, an uncomplicated story about it. But there's enough there for me to walk away going, oh no, I think that the way of Jesus, whatever else it might be, includes willingness to paint with the colors I've got. It's not about getting it right. The idea of right belief as the thing that makes God happy is, there are very few things about which I would say this. That's categorically absurd. It's impossible. And over again, Jesus illustrates its impossibility. And doesn't just leave us with nothing, but with the possibility, the beauty, the complexity of a call to act with what we've got.